someone told me it would be, and he's right. Okay, we'll call the meeting to order. We're really pleased to be here at Southern Utah University and beautiful Cedar City, and we're going to go right into the President's report. We're going to turn the time over to President Scott Wyatt to give us a report on the university.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. As long as dinner was good, it doesn't matter if my
Okay, can you hear me? Terrific. Well, it is an honor to have you on our campus. I think I can speak for my colleagues at places like Dixie and USU that the further we are away from the Wasatch Front, the more happy we are to have you visit us, because we're kind of on the outskirts. I'm often asked what it's like to be the president of university, and this first picture is my effort to describe that. It is, in fact, a typical day at work. You've asked us to report on a couple things, and one is one of the strategies that we're working on towards your strategic objective of timely completion, and then secondly, mental health. So I'd like to begin with this timely completion. The goal is to increase the percentage of students who persist to completion. The goal for the metric is 28 awards per 100 FTE, and I'm pleased to announce today that SUU has met and exceeded that goal. And building on this morning's conversation, ahead of time and under budget. And as you can see here, the school has grown by about 24% over the last 10 years, but the awarding of degrees has grown by 61%. So the faculty and staff at SUU are taking on additional work and performing at even greater higher levels as they help our students move towards success. There's a paper on your desk. As we talk about retention, I'm often asked a question about how the selective enrollment, the selective admission process at SUU has an impact on retention. And so Dr. Jared Tibbetts and Dr. Eric Kirby put together this paper that approaches this question from a number of assumptions. And I just want to hit one of these. From about 1993 to 2006, the admission standard at SUU was 80. It's the metrics. And during that period of time, the highest annual retention rate was 70%. In 2007, the admission index was increased to 85, and retention actually dropped. The highest rate in that period of time was 69. And then it was upped to 90 in 2011, all of these prior to my arriving here. And the highest retention rate during that period of time was 66. There wasn't a direct correlation between the change of admission standards and the change in our retention rates. In 2014, the university, that's the year I arrived, we took a really serious look at retention. Brought in Jared Tibbetts, found a few other people on his team, and this is really a large, large story, as you know. But since that time, the retention rate has gone up considerably. Here it is tracking through that period of time where there was no change in the retention or no change in the admission standard, but as you can see, we've gone from 65 to 71, and then even higher than that. This is actually from 2014, when we got really serious about this, we've seen more than a 10% increase in retention. And also on your desk, last month in the Chronicle of Higher Education, and I think that you all know this is the main publication in our industry, but last month on the cover of the Chronicle is an SUU student. There's a wonderful story highlighting the challenge of retention and completion that features Southern Utah University and those things that we're doing. So you've got both the white paper that we prepared, and you've got this Chronicle article in front of you that you can look at. I'm very proud of the group that we've got. What it takes is to have an all-encompassing campus working together in a coordinated effort. We need somebody to lead the effort, but it takes everybody to be engaged. And my congratulations to Dr. Cook and his team of faculty members, and to Dr. Tibbetts and his team of student affairs providers. But you know that the reality is that the grounds crew are helping us with retention. Everyone on campus is making a difference. With respect to the strategies that we are employing to help move the timely completion goal of yours forward, I'd like to actually highlight four briefly in two separate initiatives. The first one is our collaboration with Southwest Tech and Southern Utah University. We've created, as you are somewhat aware, a dual enrollment program, which means that every student at Southwest Tech who chooses to participate will be awarded credit as they move through their certificate programs. So a student that comes to Southwest Tech and takes welding, for example, we have tied that with our engineering department. Our faculty have looked through all of the courses offered in welding and have assessed the appropriate amount of credit that should be given. And as a student moves through the competencies, they're given credit based on the competency. They can take that credit and go anywhere they want. It doesn't have to come to SUU, but we give them a transcript as they move through. This whole plan began as we asked the question, what obligation do we owe to our students that come here who don't complete, who for whatever reason aren't prepared, don't know what their plans are? How do we take care of those students, and what is our obligation? And from that discussion, it led us to what are the other alternatives? What can we do to help them? And that led us to partnering with Southwest Tech. So this program really, even though we have found ways to give credit to the students, and we're working very close with our accreditation team at Northwest, who is excited about this project, and have told us that they've never seen this done before, this exact strategy. But it's as much about helping students at SUU who are not prepared or ready or interested or don't know what they're doing to move over to Southwest Tech. So the stackable credential is going both directions, not just one. It's really an important part to us. And every question as we have been working through this is answered in the same way. What is in the best interest of the students? And so when they take a welding class that may become a requirement for theater technology, as an example, when they take a welding class, we're not offering it on our campus. We will have them take it at Southwest Tech. It saves us money. It helps them with enrollments. And in the end, it costs the student less because the student will pay the Southwest Tech tuition rather than university tuition. I could talk for an hour about this, and so I'm gonna go to the next slide. This is such an exciting venture. All of the governance, and management remains as is. This is kind of like a merger without a merger, with all the benefits accruing to the student. The second one is SUU's new three-year bachelor's degree concept. So we can't afford to do this without some help. You may see this in our budget request. But the concept is that if we can take students from 4 years to three, and instead of the fourth year, have them take two summers. They'll get the same amount of work in 3 years. They might have to give up a minimum wage job for two summers and trade that for a full-time professional salary for one additional year, so they come out ahead. The university comes out way ahead, and so does the state, if we can make this work, because the instead of hiring three faculty members with three offices, we can hire two faculty members with two offices, as they teach three semesters instead of two. So the savings are great. The impact on the community is very positive. We increase summer. Ultimately, we would decrease fall and spring a little bit as we stabilize the year. Housing becomes less expensive for students because the landlords are now able to rent housing out for a full year instead of just for two semesters. And ultimately, we believe we'll be asking for less buildings and everything else because we're just saving a lot of money. You take, anyway, again, this is one I could talk about forever, so I better stop and click on. But I'm delighted to be engaged in any questions or conversations about these initiatives. The challenge is that students are struggling to take summer classes because although we offer those classes with plateau tuition, it's very expensive to take just one, and we're not able to spend the money to make a full summer program like we have in the fall. So with a little bit of financial help, building up the summer to a full schedule, moving our scholarships from 4 years to eight semesters so that students can spend it in the summer, all those kinds of strategies, we believe that we can motivate at least 50% of our students into this three-year program. The next issue you've asked me to address is mental health. This is such a challenge, but it's a challenge that we welcome because we care about these students deeply. The industry standard is to have one full-time senior level counselor for every 1,000 to 1,500 students. As you heard this morning, 6 or 7 years ago, we had one full-time senior level counselor. We now have a ratio of 1 to 1,195. So we're on the very good end of this. If we add our three doctoral interns who are working full-time but have some supervision, so we call them two full-time equivalents, we're actually better than the highest level of recommendation. We're at 1 to 896. But even with that, during peak periods, there's still a wait list of 5 to 6 weeks. This is a real challenge for us. We're going to continue working on it. I think the challenge is a little bit greater in rural areas because the resources in the community are lacking. Well, with that, I have a top 10 list. So that's my report, but I'd like to share with you a few things that have been going on. You may remember a few years ago, SUU petitioned for and received from you permission to have a master's degree in cybersecurity. There were some questions about whether we could handle this well and whether it would be a good degree. Delighted to tell you that just recently the NSA and the Department of Homeland Security has designated us as a national center of academic excellence for how well that program is going and how needed it is in the country. Congratulations to Dr. Cook and his team for that program. Number nine, you remember the Bryan Head fire? This is just one of dozens of examples, hundreds of examples, of the kinds of research and community service going on with our faculty. SUU brings in every year, if we compare us to the U, this is a very small number, but I think if we compare us to regional universities our size, this is a very good number. We bring in $10 million worth of grants per year. Dr. Grant here is, one of the things that she does as a biologist is collect seeds during the good years so that they can be planted during fire years to help rejuvenate quickly, and she's engaged the faculty, or the community members and students in this project. Number eight, SUU, the smallest and lowest funded school in the Big Sky Conference, has now won the football championship 2 out of 3 years. And I have to say, for Norm's benefit, we shared the title with Weber last year. But as I talk about athletics, I want to make another point, and that is, in athletics, we have one of only 10 female, 1 out of 10, so 10% of female athletic directors. I'm not talking about Shivali yet. But 1 out of 10 athletic directors in the country for D1 schools are women, and our athletic director is a very talented Debbie Corum. We also have the only, as far as we have been able to determine, the only female head coach of a men's sport in Sadaf, who's the coach of our men's tennis team. And I can say that the tennis team has done much better with her than it had been before her. Over the last 2 years, we have created at SUU for the first time an inclusion and diversity center. And then just this year, we hired our first full-time chief diversity officer in Dr. Shavella Rivera. And she is doing a spectacular job. Her office is right next to mine. This is really an important issue for us, diversity and inclusion. There's 2 8s. I had 11, so I thought those two, I'd marry them. Number 7, SUU for the second time was the National Outdoor Championship. This involved 2,300 people, almost all of them students on our campus, who joined in the National Outdoor Championship competition and clobbered all of the opponents. It was a really fun experience. It's our effort to try to connect with our region, with the environment that's around us, and actually winning this kind of a championship when we have thousands of students involved is a more significant win for the school than any of the other kinds of championships, because it really pulls us together. This was four weeks this year, competing against schools all over the country. This is sponsored by the Outdoor Foundation, who's that same group. It's the nonprofit group of the Outdoor Realtors Association. Number 6, Experiential Learning Leadership Institute. I want to broaden this. SUU has been connected with the National Society for Experiential Education. You may remember a few years ago, we won the National Award for the Best Project. This is really a great credit to Dr. Cook and to Dean, now I've just forgotten his name. Clark, I've known him for a long time. This is what happens when you stand in front of a group. And Dr. Clark, who have been building this experiential opportunity on our campus, we are now the host of the journal for NESI. We have their archives on our campus. We are running this Leadership Institute. And now, just this week, the Board of Governors of NESI has said that SUU will be the controller and keeper of all content for all of their programs, including the prestigious Experiential Education Academy. We think that's a recognition of the great work of experiential education that's going on at this campus. 3 best of states this year. This was not a self-nomination. Community member nominated us for these different awards. Best in State Educational Institution, Curriculum Development, and Volunteer Service. I don't think that there is a university in the country that has more volunteer hours per student than SUU. I've tried to find one and I can't find one. Number 4, we had the MOU signing with Southwest Tech. Big deal. Justin Harding, the governor's chief of staff, drove down, Commissioner Wolstenholme, several legislators, the trustees from both institutions, and then a whole lot of community members making the MOU signing, and we're Excited with the progress that we've had. Dr. Steve Meredith on our campus has been doing a great job leading this work. SUU's new business building, we will break ribbons, cutting the ribbon next month. It also was ahead of schedule, but unfortunately not ahead of budget. We received funding from the legislature through the process of yours for $8 million. We thought at the time it would cost us $9 million, but with inflation, we've had to raise more than $12 million towards this project. But we're thrilled about how it's coming together and what it's going to mean for our campus. You may remember that this business building, the lead donor for it, was the Dixie and Ann Levitt Foundation. It's the largest gift in SUU's history. $7.5 million gift announcement at that time for the building plus scholarships. And as I mentioned to you earlier today, though I'd love to reiterate it, over the last 10 years, SUU has raised 72% of the cost of all new capital development projects. Quite a tribute to Stuart Jones and his team of fundraisers and the university for building a reputation that invites these kind of contributions for us. Number two, again, our highest retention rate ever. We've hit 71%, and all projections are that it will be higher again next year. I'm going to forget this unless I say it now, but I want to make a special thank you to Mindy Benson and to Jennifer Oberhelman for the preparations for these meetings and making sure that everything has gone smoothly. It is really a lot of time, and it's late nights, and it's a lot of stress to make sure that they've got everything just perfect. Well, number one, drum roll. This is an excerpt from our commencement speaker. I'll let it speak for itself.
As I begin this morning, there is a small matter of business.
This is Ann Levitt.
I want to answer your question. Why in the world is this nice lady our commencement speaker? There is a story to tell. Most of you have had ample time to discover that President Scott Wyatt is a fun-loving leader. He's young and savvy and clues into things like memes and Twitter feeds. And when he realized that graduation day would fall on May the 4th, he immediately thought, "May the 4th be with you." Star Wars Day. His next thought was, what could be more fun than to have Mark Hamill address the graduates? The idea grew until it was so compelling it couldn't be restrained. The trustees were captivated, imagining Luke Skywalker here at SUU. So President Wyatt made a diligent effort to entice Mr. Hamill to come. Unfortunately, after careful consideration, thereby wasting much time, Mr. Hamill politely declined. Undaunted, President Wyatt tried James Earl Jones. Imagine how wonderful it would have been to have had Darth Vader. But sadly, he also sent his regrets. So he searched for any connection to May 4th. Now, I didn't know he knew that I did the stunt work for Princess Leia. But I was born on May 4th. Today happens to be my 86th birthday. And I'm his friend and was much less likely to turn him down. Thus, the invitation was graciously made and gratefully accepted. I have no problem being the third choice behind such an auspicious duo. But you should be grateful because his first choice was Chewbacca. Oh, Chewbacca, I'm so sorry, but he asked me, and I agreed. So let me say, I'm a little startled, but sincerely honored to be with you today. This May 4th is also...
So there's nothing like an 86-year-old calling a 57-year-old young. That's Ann Levitt. She's the author of the SUU history. And her husband, the largest donors to Southern Utah University. Terrific support family. For which we're grateful, and also the mother of our board chair, Eric Levitt. This is, in fact, all about the students and trying to find a way to engage them, to make sure that they know that it's them that we care about, that it's them that we're focused on. And it's just an honor to be part of it. I didn't mention, though I intended to, that as we get close to the dedication of this business building next month, that people like Marvin Dodge and Tiger Funk are going to be spending less nights awake or asleep because of all the management issues and challenges that come with that. I really do have a wonderful team to work with here, not just the team that I directly work with on a day-to-day basis, but faculty and staff all the way across campus. I've mentioned this to our facilities crew that, in fact, the first job I had in higher education was as a custodian. And the supervisor that I had cared about me and wanted to make sure that I was successful. And that some of the supervisors we have in our grounds crew and custodial crews who work with students day to day actually have as much of an impact on students' mental health, well-being, the likelihood that they complete, as much as just about anybody else, because they're with them constantly, mentoring, encouraging, and motivating them along. So even those employees who feel like they're tucked in a back office somewhere, we're trying to create that culture where they know that they're valued and that that everyone has one job. And everyone's job here is success of students. It's one job. We all just have different ways of going about it. Anyway, thank you very much for your trust and confidence. And thank you to the trustees who have been engaged with us over the last few days in helping us think through everything that we can be doing as we continue to reinvent ourselves. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, President Wyatt. Wonderful job. Our next matter of business, we have a new member of the Board of Regents, our new student regent, Jaquel Larson. Jaquel, if you'll come up here, we're going to administer the oath of office to you.
Thank you.
we're really delighted to, it really enriches our experience to have students as members of the Board of Regents. The very first, here's a trivia question for any of you know who the very first student regent was? It's actually a good friend of mine. We went to school together, Tim Zoff. So it was back in 1970, would have been 76, I believe, or 77. So it's a great tradition, and we look forward to your input and welcome you. We now have a resolution that Vice Chair Nina Barnes is going to read into the record.
Thank you, Chair. It's my privilege to give the resolution of appreciation to Joyce Valdez, our former regent. Joyce served on the Utah Board of Trustees from 2009 to 2013. She also has been involved in many other numerous community boards and committees, such as the Utah School of Applied Technology in Salt Lake City. She's worked at SLIC. She's been the liaison for many districts under the Mayor Becker in Salt Lake, working with diversity. She's also shown a lifelong commitment to service and community involvement. She was on the National Hispanic Task Force Advisory Committee. Also done work with the Utah State Commission for Women and Families and the Head Start Policy Council. All of us who had an opportunity to work with Joyce know what a great contributor she was to the Board of Regents, and particularly to the issue of diversity and inclusion. She's been a champion. Personally, I had the opportunity to meet her husband and read the book that he wrote. If any of you have ever had an opportunity, no one makes it alone about his story in Salt Lake and what a pioneer he's been in the Hispanic community and the legal community, and together the reputation they've created across the state to serve underprivileged populations. So we greatly admire and appreciate her service on the Board of Regents. Whereas Mrs. Valdez diligently attended into her duties as regent and enhanced the Board of Regents in the Utah system of higher education through her thoughtful contributions, particularly concerning higher education, access for minority populations, and women. Now, therefore, let it be resolved that the Utah State Board of Regents, joined by the Commissioner of Higher Education and his entire staff, and the institution presidents, faculty, staff, and students who have worked with Joyce Valdez, hereby extend sincere appreciation and respect and wish her the very best in her future endeavors.
Thank you very much. We have that as a motion. We have a second.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you very much. We're going to turn the time over to Commissioner Bueller to, we have the general consent calendar. Let's do that first. Are there any questions about any of the items in the consent calendar? Not, we have a motion to accept it.
So moved.
The motion, second. All in favor say aye. We have an aye? Yeah. Silent ayes. Okay.
Make us do it again.
Any opposed? Now we'll turn the time over to Commissioner Bueller to for adoption of policy R250.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is under tab B in your board of materials. There's been quite a bit of discussion this year about how higher education institutions might most appropriately engage state legislators. There have been concerns raised by both on the legislative side and the executive side. There was a bill filed that ultimately did not go anywhere because the governor agreed to do some things by executive order, which he then did. Under the current executive order, it prohibits any expenditures towards legislators. So if a legislator was invited to an event at one of our institutions and there were sweet rolls there, the legislator is supposed to pay for that sweet roll, for example. And so we did not feel this was the most workable way to approach this. And so around the end of May, board leadership and a few presidents and I met with the governor, lieutenant governor, his chief of staff, others from his staff, and this was one of a number of topics that we discussed with them. It was generally agreed that perhaps this would be better handled by regent policy over the institutions. Members of my staff and I then met with members of the governor's staff, and this is what we are recommending today that has their agreement and concurrence. So let me just kind of walk through the main provisions of this. First, it designates who may, just by policy, may represent the institution at the legislature. It designates this as a president, a senior vice president or equivalent, or legislative liaison, and provides that in some cases there may be two legislative liaisons designated by an institution. Also, that a president has the opportunity to designate for specific purposes any member of their institution to communicate with the legislature. Secondly, it ties into the policy the current state law that involves legislative lobbyist disclosure and regulations with some very important exceptions. It provides that food and beverage may be provided at events as long as it does not exceed the state per diem, which I think currently is about $46 or $48 per day. It also allows that items, say, ballpoint pen or some other items of nominal value up to $10 may be provided. And it also provides an exemption, which if there's an event where all legislators are invited, then that is an exemption as well. It also provides that, let's see, just make sure I've got this right, that that institutions may host legislators at events. So if there were like a lecture, a production of some kind, a student, you know, whatever it may be, that they may invite them to any of these with the following limitation, that legislators are limited to be invited to two institution-sponsored men's football or basketball event per calendar year. And then it also provides that institutions will provide an annual report of any expenditures on legislators. This is actually something that we used to follow until the state statute was amended a few years ago, and we do not believe it will be burdensome to the institutions and provide some appropriate disclosure, which we think is very appropriate. So this is something that I feel is a very workable solution to a problem that has come up, to some concerns that have been raised. It's appropriate for public institutions to conduct themselves in this way. I will say that this is not without some anxiety on the part of members of our system, but I believe that this is a very good path forward, and so I strongly recommend it to you for your consideration. I'd be happy to respond to any questions if there are any. If there's some technical questions, I'll invite Jeff Landward to help me with those as well.
Yes.
I don't have any questions, but I was thrilled to read this. I think this is a great thing, and I would make a motion to approve.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there any other, any discussion, questions?
So they can go to all the soccer games they want.
That's right. Oh. Volleyball, any of those.
Okay. Motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you very much. And I really appreciate the commissioner's work and his staff, some of the presidents, in trying to put together a workable solution to this problem. We're going to ask Associate Commissioner Spencer Jenkins to discuss the revision of policy R714.
Thank you. I'll try and keep this brief. This policy has very little to do with capital facilities, but it has a lot to do with community impact. Under policy 714, we were approached by a couple of groups this last legislative session about immunizations on campus and what efforts our institutions do to inform students of their immunization opportunities. We are aware that several schools notify students when they come and live on campus of their immunization opportunities. This is a policy that standardizes that, and it requires all of the for all students who live on campus to receive notification from the school about their notification or their immunization opportunities. It's supported by a committee at the Utah Department of Health that works on public immunizations. They are the ones that approached us with this. There was going to be a national person here to come speak today, but her travel did not make it for her to be here. But with that, I'll be open to any questions.
Okay, are there any questions of any of the regents about this policy? If not, we have a motion to accept this revision to policy.
So move.
Is there a second? Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you very much. I'm going to turn the time over to Commissioner Buehler, and he'll kick off a little discussion about the progress report on our strategic plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, we spent some time yesterday at our joint session. This document is in your folders, in case you did not, to make sure you have it, in case you didn't pick one up yesterday. I won't take a lot of time on this. I mostly want to focus on the new metrics that are included that we think will help align better to the actual strategic objectives of the plan. These are located beginning on page 9 of the document, and I'd like to invite Associate Commissioner Kimberly Henry to walk through what each of these are. Kimberly?
All right, thanks, Dave. In order to advance the board's strategic objectives of affordable access, timely completion, workforce research, and capacity, we recognize that a key component is to identify a way to measure progress. During yesterday's meeting, the commissioner briefly mentioned that we had an expanded list of 8 system-wide metrics that we've developed and that we're asking you to consider as part of today's meeting. As a reminder, when the board originally adopted its strategic plan in 2015, it adopted 2 metrics: college participation of high school graduates and the number of degrees per 100 FTE. As we've been working through the strategic planning process, we're recommending that the board consider expanding these metrics to a list of 8 that each have a tie to the 4 strategic objectives of the board. Beyond just identifying what the metric is and the definition of what it is, we've also identified a benchmark, so what the metric would be measured against, and a goal for each metric. So this is something that's a bit new as well. When looking at the metrics, questions are going to arise whether these are the right metrics and associated goals. Many of these metrics are new, and the goals should be considered a starting point for the board. If these are not the right goals, we can always come back and adjust them. We just need something in place to start the conversation. The strategic plan is meant to be a working document, and we would expect that this process will be reviewed and assessed annually to look at the metrics, discuss where they are effective in nature, and whether the goals should be adjusted. So very quickly, on page 9, you will see affordable access. We have 2 new goals that we're metrics we're advancing for your consideration. The current metric of college participation rate of high school graduates, which measures the percentage of Utah high school graduates who enroll within 5 years of high school graduation. All of you are familiar with this particular metric. This is one that we've had before, and it's one we've been tracking. The second metric with respect to affordability we're looking at is brand new. As we've discussed as a board, affordability is a very personal issue and very difficult to assess. One of the factors that we know is that Utah is recognized as having the 4th lowest 4-year tuition, and I want to be very careful in saying 4-year tuition, and is considered affordable. That's we tout that metric all of the time. It was determined that a metric which helps to display what that actually means for students may be a starting point to how we start to measure affordability. The metric selected is the percentage of full-time resident students who do not require loans, grants, or scholarships to pay for college. So when we looked back at our existing student population, Utah residents attending full-time, so 30 semester hours in a year, 19% of those students do not receive aid of any sort. They're just coming to our campuses. Our goal would be to maintain this percentage as we grow over time. This metric is not designed to discourage students from taking advantage of student aid and loans if necessary, but rather focus on the cost to ensure that students who don't qualify for aid or who may not want to take out loans are not priced out of the market. So if we're saying that we're affordable today, and this is what today's student mix and payment mix looks like, we're saying at least maintain that moving forward. Now, again, a new metric may be difficult as we look forward at this, but it could be some a starting point. And if it's the wrong metric, we start over and start again. The next metric for timely completion will be adjusted to time to graduation, measuring the number of semesters needed to complete a college degree. As we know, the standard for a bachelor's degree should be 12 semesters. An associate's degree should be 6. Unfortunately, only 55% of our students are completing a bachelor's degree in 12 semesters, and 20% of our students are completing an associate's degree in 6 semesters. Now, there are all kinds of nuances associated with the associate's degrees. They may not be looking to finish the associate's degree, but we want to start to encourage those students to stop, achieve that milestone, celebrate, and then move on. Under the workforce, we've identified or determined a metric to use as the return on a student's investment by measuring the wage premium that a student experiences for every dollar that they pay in tuition, based on whether the student earns an associate or a bachelor's degree. So this is new data that we would have, again, a new metric. So if I'm a student, I'm coming, I'm entering into the workforce, we have students who graduate with their associate's degree earning $6 per tuition dollar that they paid. If you're a student who graduates with a bachelor's degree, that return on investment is closer to $20 for every tuition dollar that you paid. And that would be, we have a metric associated with that, and we would track that over time to ensure that students feel that their investment in their education is resulting in an impact in the workforce. Finally, there are 4 new metrics being proposed under the capacity and growth section. In this section, as financial stewards of the system of higher education, we're asked not only to keep track of and manage costs, but to leverage our resources to get the most out of each dollar and each square foot of our building. These metrics will begin to provide a baseline related to cost per award, cost per FTE, and space utilization, while also measuring the impact that higher education has on the economy through the return on investment realized by additional income paid by UC graduates over a 30-year time frame as compared to the state investment of tax dollars. The details, the benchmarks, and the goals are on pages 8, 9, or 9 and 10 and 11, and we would encourage any questions that you have. But again, this is a starting point. It's something that helps us step down the road a little bit farther as it's related to goals, as it's related to benchmarks, and as it's related to metrics. These metrics would help us with our conversations with the legislative fiscal analyst, as well as the governor's office throughout the legislative session, as well as when we develop our budget request moving forward.
Okay. Thank you very much, Commissioner, and thank you very much, Kimberly. And I'll note that this wasn't in our diligent board materials pre-distributed because a lot of changes were being made kind of even up to the last couple of days. But we wanted to have some discussion here and see if we're ready to adopt this or whether how you'd like to proceed with this. And we'd really like to also encourage some input from the presidents. Do you have anybody have any comment as we kick this off? Ms. President Cockett?
I look to my fellow presidents here, but I'm not sure I've seen this before. Have I seen this?
No.
Okay. So obviously I would like more time to consider it. I'm not sure when the next COP meeting is, but this might be something. I would actually like to see a breakout of each of these benchmarks per institution mm-hmm. rather than a combined, because what
the metric right now is just from the system-wide perspective.
I know, but
have on many of them.
But I think for our discussion, we would want to see institution by institution what this goal is doing. I do recall from a couple of regent meetings ago, we did see the classroom usage data by institution, but I'm not sure I've seen the other two.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I kind of like the fact that we're looking at metrics. That's one of the things I felt was missing when we put the strategic plan together here. Last year, the year before. And so whether these are the right metrics or not, I think we need to give the presidents some time to look through, and I agree with President Cockett that we need to see what institution, and one thing, maybe every institution doesn't exactly have the same goal. We ought to let them say, what goal can they meet, and then add those up and say, can we meet the goal that we've set as a system, and maybe we adjust that, or maybe we go back to an institution and say, you got to do better. But I think it'd be hard to adopt today where we just have barely seen it. Maybe we need to
call
our September meeting.
I mean, I think we probably need to President Cockett's point, we really need to figure out, if we don't have the data by institution, it's a little hard to, I mean, ultimately, if we're creating a system goal, we need to break that down into its component parts for each of the institutions and have a discussion about what does that mean for each institution in terms of what they contribute to achieving the goal. Yes. And I think it could be helpful to us to maybe take another step and say, what does this look like by institution? And to have some discussion at the Council of Presidents about, get your feedback in terms of, are these the right metrics? I mean, I think we all are kind of anxious to make sure we have metrics in place and that we can start to measure this, but we wanted to be sure we have the right ones.
Yes.
Any other thoughts or feedback?
President.
Yeah, President.
I just would echo that. I think I agree that metrics are really important. It would just be nice, to have some time, but I'm thinking specifically in my instance, the affordability metric. Looking at what happens in our full-time student population at a community college is not an accurate metric. At USU and Utah State and others, it may be, mm-hmm. but we may have to delineate with community colleges and look at, that metric is gonna show you not whether we're serving underserved low-income students, which is part of our mission. That's not gonna show you that. So letting us kind of help identify a metric, especially in particular areas where our mission is really centric to that workforce or affordability.
May I just comment, Mr. Chair? As Kimberly mentioned, these are intended to be system measures, not by institution. And I think but that's a discussion we can have. It is presented to the board today as a draft. I believe that we did have input from the Business Affairs Council on these. Did we not, Kimberly?
Starting point in the conversation, and it's the same thing. We like the concept of metrics. We're not sure what the metric should be, and that's kind of where the conversation stalls
out. If the sense of the board is that they would like us to take some more time, we can certainly do that.
Any other thoughts, President?
Just one brief comment. I would say on the capacity and growth section, there are some innovative ideas here that I would want to compliment and praise. I think particularly the ROI, we're all being asked to talk about that and document it, and nobody has figured out a good way to do this. So in some ways, this is a path-breaking kind of effort. So I applaud the work and kind of echo the opportunity that we could all have to talk a little bit more about which of these make the most sense for us. And there's a number of these that are very industry standard, well accepted, retention completion, 150% time metrics. So there's some I don't think need to debate at all. And then some of the new ones is probably where we have a real potential to do something interesting. So thanks for the start.
Yeah, I think this is a situation where we're not going to all end up at exactly the spot we want to be necessarily, but this is an important process. And we've all wanted to make sure that we have objective, verifiable stretch goals. And I agree, Commissioner, that having system goals is what we're looking for, but for the institutions to know, how do I contribute to that? And I agree, it's gonna be different for a community college maybe than an R1 institution, but I think the presidents have to feel comfortable with how they roll up into that number, and for us as regents to feel comfortable with their role in that. But I applaud the effort here, and I think we're moving in the right direction, so.
I just add, I think ideally, we'd like to see the institutions take this back to their boards of trustees and have a conversation about here's where we are, and here's where we'd, so that we have alignment across the system, and that we understand that the pieces are gonna add up to the whole. Yes?
So it'd be.
President, here you go.
I think we can still have a system metric that may only apply to a subset of schools. So it's possible that we would have a metric that separates out Salt Lake Community College as an example, because we have goals for the Comprehensive Community College or for those that participate in that. But it'd be nice if we could do what we're describing. I'm just encouraging this effort to divide it out a little bit, because we're not all the same.
Well, and if something doesn't work, don't just say to us it doesn't work, come up with some solutions and some ideas. And I think that's what President Heftalen came with, and hey, this metric might not work for us, but let us look and see what we could come up with as a metric that would work for our group. So I like that approach.
Thank you. Regent Larson.
I would argue, though, that the schools, I think, need to have some sort of idea of where they're at with the measurements of these. I'd like to see the data, to President Cockett's point, just to kind of see, even though we don't have maybe data for every institution, I understand that that might be difficult to get, but I would like to see kind of where the schools are at with each of those metrics, so then we can have this conversation of, you know, is this the right metric for our institutions, and do we need to maybe subset that out?
Yes.
I'm going to try to change tone a little bit and ask the regents, as we've been charged the last year to work on these three top initiatives right here, the four here of these strategic objectives, how do you feel as committees? Because I know I've looked through the lens of completion, and I'm so pleased to see some of our top initiatives and ideas right in the document, and know they're not going to be lost. They're very critical to the work of the committee, and representative of the system and those we visited with. But how do the other committees feel, or any regents feeling that the work you did is reflected?
Regent Prince.
I think this is one of those classic examples that the discussion, the conversation is every bit as important as the resolution that we finally adopt. As long as the conversation is continuing and robust and is taken as a serious objective, I think we win by continuing this conversation.
Yeah. I do too. I think we'll take, we'll all, this will all have a lot more gravity with the institutions with us if we make sure that we're thinking through this before we do it. Could we suggest maybe that we have, maybe we can ask the commissioner, we're thinking about kind of what process we'd want to engage in, but we could certainly come back and address this again in September.
Let's do that. I'm certainly happy to do that, and we will share this with COP at our next COP meeting. They'll have some time now. They have, you know, about 6 weeks between now and then to look at it, and then we'll plan to come back to you in the September meeting with the finished product after getting that.
I think too, if we could get, maybe figure out where we have
now
data gaps at the institutional level.
Yes.
That would be very useful. Yeah. Okay. All right. We don't need a motion, I think, on that, but we'll proceed in that fashion. And really want to thank both the commissioner's his staff for the work that's they've put into this. We don't want to diminish that at all. I think we would just want to make sure that this is a thorough process so that this becomes, that their work becomes meaningful to us. So thank you very much. Mm-hmm. We're gonna take a few minutes. One of our favorite annual activities is open meeting training. We're gonna turn a few minutes over to Associate Commissioner Spencer Jenkins to take us through some open meeting training.
I think you'll be glad it's not me, it's the video that will keep you entertained.
Maybe I could just mention, this is required by law annually for every board. And This is a video prepared by the state auditor's office to accomplish the objective of that law. You've seen it before, you may see it again.
Welcome to the Office of the State Auditor's introductory video on the Open and Public Meetings Act. In this video, we are going to discuss the basic requirements for local government entities as specified in Utah's Open and Public Meetings Act. It is the responsibility of a governing body's presiding officer to ensure that the body's members receive annual training on the requirements of this law. By the end of this video, you should understand what the Utah Open and Public Meetings Act requires of local government entities and how to fulfill those requirements. The Open and Public Meetings Act recognizes that governing bodies exist to conduct the people's business and contains provisions designed to help ensure that an entity's actions and deliberations are conducted openly. In order to understand what the Open and Public Meetings Act requires, it is first important to understand what the Act considers an open meeting. An open and public meeting is when the majority of a governing body meets to discuss or act upon the business of the entity. Public meetings include workshops and executive sessions, but do not include chance or social meetings. A public hearing is the portion of an open meeting at which members of the public are provided with a reasonable opportunity to comment on the subject of the hearing. If necessary, the governing body may limit speaking time. Public hearings are required when an entity imposes or increases a tax or fee or adopts a budget. An electronic meeting is a public meeting convened over the phone or by other electronic means. A governing body may convene an electronic meeting only if they have adopted a resolution, rule, or ordinance governing the use of electronic meetings. Under this Act, all meetings must be open to the public unless the meeting is closed to discuss one of the following: the character, competence, or health of an individual, the deployment of security personnel, devices, or systems, collective bargaining issues, pending or reasonably imminent litigation, the purchase, sale, lease of real property, including any form of water right or shares, if an open discussion would prevent the entity from completing the transaction on the best possible terms, investigative proceedings regarding allegations of criminal misconduct, and finally, discussion of information that is required to be maintained as private or protected by the Utah Procurement Code, including trade secrets. A closed meeting may be held only upon the affirmative vote of 2/3 of the governing body members present at a public meeting. During a closed meeting, a governing body may not do any of the following: interview a person applying to fill an elected position, discuss filling a midterm vacancy or temporary absence, discuss the character, professional competence, or physical or mental health of the person whose name was submitted for consideration to fill a midterm vacancy or temporary absence, or approve or pass any ordinance, resolution, rule, regulation, contract, or appointment. If a meeting is closed to discuss the character, competence, or health of an individual, or the deployment of security personnel, devices, or systems, then the person presiding shall sign a sworn, written statement affirming that the sole purpose for closing the meeting was to discuss one of these issues. In these cases, no recording or written minutes are required. However, if a closed meeting is held for any other reason, the closed portion of the meeting must be recorded, and detailed written minutes may be kept. Both a recording and written minutes of a closed meeting are considered protected records. The governing body may call an emergency meeting to discuss an urgent matter due to unforeseen circumstances. In order to hold an emergency meeting, 1, best notice practical of the time, location, and topics to be considered must be given. 2, an attempt to contact all governing body members must be made. And three, a majority of the governing body members must approve the meeting. The Open and Public Meetings Act imposes certain notice requirements on local government entities. Entities that hold regular meetings, which are scheduled in advance over the course of a year, need to give public notice at least once a year of their meeting schedule. This notice must include the date, time, and place of the meetings. For entities that do not hold regular meetings, the governing body must give at least 24 hours public notice specifying the date, time, and place. All meetings, whether regularly scheduled in advance over the course of a year or scheduled as needed, must provide no less than 24 hours notice of meeting agendas. The method of providing public notice for meetings and agendas depends upon whether a public hearing will be held during a portion of the meeting. It is important to distinguish between notice requirements for regular meetings and notice requirements for a meeting that will include a public hearing. If a public hearing is going to be held, the notice must be published in at least one issue of a newspaper. If a newspaper of general circulation is not available, then written notice should be posted in three public places within the entity's boundaries. For regular meetings, an entity is only required to notify a local media correspondent and does not need to pay for the notice if the newspaper chooses not to publish it. Additionally, for public hearings, notice generally must be given at least 7 days prior to the meeting. For both regular meetings and public hearings, written notice must be posted at the principal office of the governing body, or, if no such office exists, at the location where the meeting is to be held. Governing bodies are required to post notice of a public meeting on the Utah Public Notice website. By posting on the website and providing the email of the newspaper or local media correspondent, governing bodies meet the requirement to notify a newspaper or local media correspondent. However, all other notice requirements for a public hearing, such as publishing notices in a newspaper, still apply. Typically, posting on the Utah Public Notice website is done by a clerk or secretary. However, it is the responsibility of the governing body to ensure this requirement is being properly met. The Public Notice website is administered by Utah State Archives, who has prepared a training manual and quick guide for owners and posters, as well as training sessions that may be accessed on their website at archives.utah.gov. Public meeting agendas must include the following: topics to be considered, reasonably specified, and each topic listed under an agenda item on the meeting agenda. The governing body may not consider a topic in an open meeting that was not on the agenda. If a new topic that was not on the agenda is raised by the public during an open meeting, the governing body may discuss the topic. However, final action may not be taken on the new topic during that meeting. If your entity is increasing a fee or undergoing truth in taxation, please be aware that there are additional notice and posting requirements. For help in these areas, please carefully study applicable laws or consult with your legal advisor. In addition to notice requirements, the Open and Public Meetings Act imposes certain requirements on the information that must be recorded during a meeting and shared afterward with the public. Meeting minutes and an audio recording need to be kept for all open meetings with limited exceptions. When a meeting, whether open or closed, is required to be recorded, the recording must be complete and unedited. It must include all portions of the meeting from the commencement through the adjournment. Recordings of open meetings must be made available to the public for listening within 3 days of the meeting. Every entity needs to establish and implement procedures for the governing body's approval of the written minutes of each meeting. Pending minutes are written minutes of an open meeting that have been prepared in draft form and are subject to change before being approved by the governing body. Pending minutes must contain a clear indication, such as a draft or pending watermark, that the governing body has not yet approved the minutes, or that the minutes are subject to change until they have been approved. After holding an open meeting, an entity must make the pending meeting minutes available to the public within 30 days. Approved minutes are written minutes of an open meeting that have been approved by the governing body. Approved minutes of an open meeting are the official record of the meeting and must be made available to the public within 3 business days. Whoever is responsible for taking the minutes during meetings needs to be familiar with what the Utah Open and Public Meetings Act requires be contained in the minutes. When a governing body closes a meeting, the following must be publicly announced and entered into the minutes of the open meeting at which the closed meeting was approved: the reason or reasons for holding the closed meeting, the location where the closed meeting will be held, and the vote of each member of the governing body, either for or against the motion to go into closed session. The recording and any written minutes of a closed meeting need to include the date, time, and location of the meeting, the names of the governing body's members present and absent, and the names of all others present, except for where disclosure would infringe upon the confidentiality necessary to fulfill the original purpose of closing the meeting. Great job. You've now finished the Open and Public Meetings Act video. You're ready to move on to the video evaluation.
Okay, thank you very much. Spencer, we appreciate that. Any questions any of you have about the act?
I might just mention, Mr. Chair, that as staff, we do make sure we follow the various things that are required of staff. There's such as posting on the open meetings website, recording and posting meetings, and so forth.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to turn the time over to Regent Jessely Anderson, Vice Chair of the Finance and Facilities Committee, to go through some items under tabs E through J.
Thank you. Great, thank you. The Finance and Facility Committee is advancing 6 action items found in tabs E through J for the board's review and approval. For each of these items, I will turn time to the respective institution or the commissioner's office representative to give a quick summary of the item and an opportunity to address any board questions. Our first action item comes from Utah State University, Southern Utah University. It's for their campus master plan approval, and Marvin Dodge will be presenting.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Regents. You'll see in your packet a map of SUU and our current master plan. There's just a couple things that I would highlight because we've tried to outline in word the changes that have occurred in the last 2 years. We recently opened our new George S. Eccles Sports Performance Center, which is item A on that map. So if you start on the left-hand side, we'll work our way around. We have the business building is item F, and as you have probably seen in driving by, that will be completed in just a matter of weeks and ready for classes to begin this fall. Item I shows some additional property that we purchased about a year ago that was the Renaissance apartment complex. There are two apartment buildings there and a number of small homes attached to that. And then the next item is part of that block, a purchase of an additional home there on that block. Item J, these are some leased properties we have, but in the lower corner, the building that looks like a lazy L there, is our new Founders Hall dormitory. This again was a private partner, public partnership with the Levitt Foundation to build a 320-bed dormitory. That is complete. We took possession of that this summer, and it is completely filled for this fall, along with all of our housing. And item O, which is a proposed building, will become our capital request this fall. This is for a technology, engineering, and design building to house those functions, and we look forward to bringing that forward.
I move to approve the Southern Utah University Campus Master Plan.
Okay, we have a motion by Regent Anderson, a second by Vice Chair Barnes. Any discussion? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
Okay. The second item is also Southern Utah University. It's a property acquisition issue, and I'll turn the time back to Marvin Dodge.
Thank you. This one, as I mentioned, is on that same block. It's just across from the Southern Utah Museum of Art. We owned several properties there before we purchased the Renaissance properties. There is only two lots that we do not own, and this is for the purchase of one of those. It is called the Worthen Home. It has largely been a vacation home for a family down in St. George who have reached the point that they were put it on the market. We have the house under contract. They were asking $650,000. We offered $575,000, which they accepted. And upon your approval, we'll proceed to close on that. It is a little over 6,000 square foot house on about a third of an acre of land. And the house is in great shape, although it's vintage 1979 because it's not been updated since. And so we've determined the Harvest Gold probably would have to go. But this becomes a strategic purchase for us as we try to acquire this entire block to expand the footprint of the university.
Are there any questions from any of the regents? Then I move that we authorize Southern Utah University to acquire this property located at 11 North 200 West in Cedar City, Utah.
Okay, thank you. We have a motion.
Second.
Second from Regent Campbell. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. The next item is Utah State University, a horse barn non-state funded project. And Vice President for Business and Finance, Dave Calley from Utah State, will be the presenter.
Thank you. The project we're requesting your approval on today is a horse barn that is adjacent to our Equine Center arena, a classroom building, and a much smaller horse barn with a smaller number of stalls. This project is necessary in order to accommodate the growing equine science and management program, which is part of our animal, dairy, and veterinary sciences department. It's a $1.8 million project. It's a 20,000 square foot building. This will allow us to accommodate the growing program, but also host additional competitions. So we will have the stall space available for all the horses needed for competitions. It's, as I said, a $1.8 million project. We are proposing to use funds available institutionally within the veterinary sciences program and the School of Veterinary Medicine, I should say. We are not seeking state funds for construction, O&M, or future capital improvements.
Are there any questions? If not, I move to authorize Utah State University to present the Horse Barn project to the Utah State Building Board for final approval.
We have a motion. Second, Regent Clyde. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
Okay, the next item comes from Snow College. It's the Campus Master Plan Amendment. And Jake Dettinger, Vice President for Business, will be our presenter.
Thank you. Just want to start on, it's the third diagram in your packet, and that's a diagram of our EFRM campus master plan. This was completed 2 years ago. And at this point, we don't have any proposed changes to that diagram, to the EFRM campus. So then we'll go to figure one, which is the first diagram in your packet, and that is our Ridgefield campus. And we do have a proposed amendment to that campus. In our original plan, we had proposed locations for future student housing on the southernmost border of our college property. And if you go to figure two, we have an updated location for that student housing, a proposed future student housing, which we'll get to on our next item on the agenda. The reason for the change is infrastructure getting there. At this point, there is no infrastructure. Basically, it's fields with weeds in between our current buildings and the southernmost border of campus. What we would do is we would move the athletic fields to the southernmost part of campus, and we would move the student housing closer. This brings our students closer to the main part of campus, so that, and it would be a significant cost savings due to the infrastructure already being there. So that is the only proposed change that we are requesting.
So figure one shows a building there where you're going to move it?
Correct. We would then propose to move that to the other side of the quad.
So where's that building go?
We'd move that to the other side of the quad.
So you haven't shown that on figure?
No, we haven't updated that, but that realistically, that's probably a 50-year plan, so. There's several other buildings that would have to come first, but yes.
Any other questions? Then I move that we approve Snow College Campus Master Plan.
I have a second from a motion, second from Regent Larson. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
We have another item from Snow College, a non-traditional arrangement for student housing in Richfield, and I'll turn to Vice President Dettinger again to present that.
Thank you. As I mentioned, the reason for our change, we are proposing an RFP to go out and work with a contractor to develop some P3, which is public-private partnership, student housing on the Richfield campus. And I'm going to turn it over to our Vice President, Student Affairs, Craig Matthey, who oversees student housing.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to tell you about our project. We're excited about it. Regents Policy 712 allows for the non-traditional use of college property for college purposes. This is what we're attempting to do. The Richfield campus is presently landlocked in that we're bordered on the west by I-70, on the east by Richfield High School, on the north and south by residential areas that are well developed. There's no access to any property for anyone to develop student-type housing. The second issue is that we've plateaued in enrollment at the Richfield campus because we depend on commuters, and we can't invite students from outside of a 50-mile or so radius to come to campus and provide student housing in the Richfield area. In the 20 years, in June of 2019, it'll be 20 years since the merger of the Richfield campus with Snow College. And in that time, we had hoped the community would step up and provide some type of student-friendly housing, but it hasn't happened. So we realize that using some of this available property is the best way to get student housing for the Richfield campus and allow continued growth. So that's what we're asking you to do today, is let us go forward with an RFP under 712 and find a developer who would like to partner with us, take the financial risk, build the property, and manage it in conjunction with the college so that we can provide housing for students to come to the Richfield campus.
Are there any questions? Then I move to authorize Snow College to issue an RFP and enter into a contract with a selected private developer contingent on continued communication and review by the Attorney General's office.
Second.
Here we have a motion by Regent Anderson, second by Regent Prince. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
Okay, our last action item is the USHE Fiscal Year 20 Budgeted Development Process Guidelines. And I'll turn to Commissioner Buehler with Associate Commissioner Kimberly Henry to present.
Thank you, Regent Anderson. This is something we have similarly brought to you this time of year, each year, to provide us the guidelines on how we will construct our budget. This outlines that it will be constructed around your strategic objectives and that we will be receiving input from the institutions on that. But I would turn to Associate Commissioner Henry if she would like to add any more detail to that. No? Okay. It's fairly straightforward.
Yeah, it's a fairly straightforward approach again this year. It just sets the guardrails for what we look at when we start the budget conversation. In the strategic plan, you've already identified that the budget request should be approximately 5% of total new ongoing revenue. So a combination of tax funds to tuition, so just again outlines that that's the expectation. It gives some timelines and instructions for the institutions with respect to providing additional follow-up information so we can provide everything that we need to with respect to the budget request. So it's pretty standard, nothing too outrageous or unexpected to be in the development guidelines.
I have a question. So there were, I don't know, I heard a couple questions from members of the legislature and GOMB last year about the format of our budget presentation. So is that changing at all in light of those questions, or have you figured out what the issue even is?
So, Dave, if you're okay, I can. So we met with Chris Cox this summer, and most of her concerns are pretty much around a lot of our metrics that go along with our budget requests. So as we submit our budget requests, they want to understand how we can evaluate higher ed as compared to other state agencies, primarily looking at performance. And so that's why the metric conversation is timely, important, but we've been working diligently with her and Jacob Wright, who is in the back of the room, all the way in the back. With respect to what we need to do and what we need to provide. And so we're finding some common ground on how we move forward. And then we have a follow-up meeting with Jonathan Ball in a couple of weeks to see from the legislative fiscal analyst perspective what it is that they're hoping for from us that is in addition to what we're already providing.
Great, thank you.
Are there any other questions? If not, I move to approve the general budget guidelines and the budget framework for the Utah System of Higher Education operating budget request for fiscal year 2019 and 18.
Okay, do we have a second? Well, motion by Regent Anderson, second by Regent Gibson. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
The Finance and Facilities Committee is now forwarding four information items for the board to consideration and review. The Finance and Facilities Committee reviewed these items in detail at our meeting earlier this week. Unless there are any questions from the Regent members, I will quickly highlight each item and would encourage you to read through them if you haven't already done so. If you do have questions, we have the institution and the USHI staff here to answer those questions. So I'll just quickly go through. The first one is the USHI Review of Finance and Facilities Committee, fiscal year 18. Over the year, the committee took action on 34 different items, including approval of budget and capital development guidelines, student fees, 6 policy-related issues, 2 campus master plan, 5 non-state funded projects, and 6 property transactions. In addition, the committee received 30 informational items highlighting the enrollment levels, debt management, auxiliary operations, institutional residences, leases, the annual legislative session, institutional benefits, and many other reports. If there are no questions, I'll continue the next. The second item is a USHI, the revenue bond results. And again, we have Associate Commissioner Kimberly Henry here and Rich Ammon in the back, the Assistant Commissioner, to answer any questions. 3 USHI institutions recently issued revenue bonds to construct facilities approved by the 2008 Utah State Legislature. Salt Lake Community College closed on $11,735,000 of bonds for their South Jordan Student Center on June 20th, last month, with an all-inclusive interest rate cost of 2.83%. Utah State University closed on $32,210,000 of bonds for phase 2 of the Space Dynamics Lab on June 21st last month, with an all-inclusive interest cost of 3.54%. The U closed on $80,400,000 $40,000 of bonds for student housing on July 17th of this week with an all-inclusive interest cost of 3.62%. Mm-hmm. Any questions? Okay. Then the next two items are just kind of housekeeping items. The first one is the 2018-19 budget initiatives use of funds received for USHE. And we have Kimberly Henry, Associate Commissioner here, and Brian Shupe, Assistant Commissioner, if there are any questions. Each institution has submitted detailed student growth and capacity, completion, and workforce initiatives for fiscal year 2018 and 19, with descriptions, rationale, justification, outcomes, assessment, and budgetary plan. This information will be included in legislative budget item follow-up reports and other requests. And the last item as part of that is the USHE 2018-19 performance-based funding initiatives. And again, we have Associate Commissioner Kimberly Henry and Assistant Commissioner Brian Shupe here. Each institution has submitted detailed performance-based funding initiatives for the $3,850,000 of ongoing appropriation in fiscal year 2018 and 19, with descriptions, rationale, justification, outcome, assessment, and budgetary plan. This information will be included in legislative budget item follow-up reports and other requests. This concludes our report.
Thank you very much, Regent Anderson. We appreciate the work of the committee and all the committee members. Thank you so much. We are now going to hear a motion from Regent Marquardt to move into executive session.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the board meet in an executive session for the sole purpose of discussing the character, professional competence, or physical or mental health of individuals and a discussion regarding the deployment of security personnel, devices, or systems.
Thank you very much. Is there a second?
Second.
A second from Regent Prince. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. We will, we're going to break for lunch, and then at 1 o'clock, maybe five after one, maybe 45 minutes for lunch, we're going to reconvene in executive session down in the Hunter room, down, I think it's the Hunter room, isn't it? Yeah, where we were for breakfast this morning, so.
Mr. Chair, may I just mention, at our lunch, we have about 30 students from SUU that will be seated among the tables. So, Regents, please take the opportunity to visit with those students and learn about their experiences. And I think this is our second time we've done this, and I know it was very well received last time. So,